Hi, this is Nicole Hemsoth, editor of HPC Wire, here with today's edition of Soundbite, our daily interview series featuring researchers, thought leaders, and newsmakers in the world of high-performance computing. On today's edition, we'll be talking with Dula Parkinson, a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab's Advanced Light Source. Dula and his team are using hard X-rays to characterize various materials, which creates some interesting data challenges. We'll touch on his research as a whole and discuss how key technologies in data management and HPC are powering his work forward. Hi, Dula. Thanks for being on today.
Hey, thanks.
If you could, tell us a little bit about the Advanced Light Source and what you're working on there.
Sure. So the Advanced Light Source is a facility located at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and it is a very bright source of X-rays. It's called a synchrotron. And so we have this big, you know, building-sized ring of electrons that speed around at close to the speed of light, and there's magnets that bend them, and at each magnet, we're generating a very bright X-ray beam. And so there's 40 different stations around this ring where there's X-rays that come down a pipe, that we call those beam lines, and at each beam line, there's an end station, and we use the X-rays to do different experiments. So there's all kinds of different kinds of magnets in there which produce X-rays with different characteristics. And so we have sort of 40 different kinds of experiments. Some are spectroscopy, some are imaging. And the end station that I run, the beamline that I run, is a hard X-ray microtomography beamline, which means that we do 3D imaging with a resolution of about a micrometer. So we usually have samples that are anywhere from a half millimeter big up to a few centimeters big.
Okay, thanks for putting that in layman's terms. So what is it you're trying to discover, and what's the implication then when your science gets published? Who's going to be most interested?
Right, so the fun but crazy thing about my beamline is just the huge variety of applications that we have, just because there's so many people that want to be able to look inside their object. So one big area that we do is material science. And so an example that we've been working on a lot recently is looking at silicon carbide ceramic composite materials that are being designed to use in jet engines or other applications where you need to have a really strong material that is strong at high temperatures. And so what we do is we'll put this material in a furnace, heat it up to over 1600 degrees Celsius, and we'll yank on it. And we'll watch the cracks form in it as we pull harder and harder. And there's these materials that we call them hierarchical materials, where there's structures at different, you know, levels of hierarchy. So there's these individual strands, and then those get in a matrix in what we call a toe, and then we weave a bunch of toes together. And so there's this woven, you know, there's all these levels of structure. And it's really interesting to watch how the cracks form, how the different fibers pull out. So there's all these different levels that are happening in this material as we pull on it at high temperature. And we're just trying to figure out, you know, what's the way that we can make the strongest material possible.
Right. It sounds like a lot of fun, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So here's another example. So we're working with it. And I should mention that, you know, this, all of the research that I'm going to tell you about is not my own research. I'm in charge of running this instrument, this beamline, and there's researchers from all over the world who come to the ALS and bring us their samples, bring us their ideas, and then we collaborate with them to make their experiments work. And, you know, what we're going to get to in a minute is, like, really to deal with the data, because at the end of the day, they need to be able to get information out of the data. They don't just want a pile of data. But anyway, so another one I want to tell you about is lithium batteries. So we're looking at these lithium batteries and how they fail, or at least one of the ways that they fail. And so what we'll do is we'll actually put a lithium battery in the beamline, we'll image it, and then we'll cycle it just back and forth, back and forth. We'll charge and discharge it. And we're actually able to see these things that they call dendrites form, and they turn into these big blisters that eventually cause the battery to short out. And so we're able to actually image that as a function of time, and, you know, see these things growing. So that's another example of in sort of the material science area. Another area that we're really big into is earth sciences. And so one of the big things that we've worked on is geologic carbon sequestration, where, you're basically, rather than trying to, when if you have a power plant, say, rather than having it spew carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, one idea to prevent that is to pump the CO2 underground instead. And so there's a lot of questions about what happens when you pump a bunch of CO2 underground. And so what we're able to do is we have this pressure vessel that simulates what it's like underground. So we take a rock core sample and we stick it in this pressure vessel and we put it under the same conditions that it experienced underground, and then we pump CO2 into it. And we're actually able to see the carbon dioxide sort of invade the pores in this rock and end up, you know, doing whatever it does, and it causes reactions, and so the structure of the rock can change. So there's just all these things that can happen. And and we're able to image that as a function of time.
Right. Very diverse applications there.
Yeah. So one more is biology, and I'll give you two examples. One is with bones, and so we have a researcher from Marquette, John Jameson, who is working with doctors in Wisconsin, and he has samples of bones from kids with a disease called osteogenesis imperfecta. It's referred to as brittle bone disease. And so it's a genetic disorder, and it leads to people, you know, the microstructure of people's bones being totally different than normal bone, which then, you know, at the macro scale, at the person size level, causes a lot of problems. And so he's actually got these samples, and he's doing a bunch of mechanical testing on these bones to see, like, what is this mechanical strength in these different ways. But then at our beamline, he's able to image them at the microscale and see how this microstructure is totally different between these different bone samples and the different types of the disease, and then correlate that back again with the treatments and the drugs that these kids are being given and seeing how that affects things.
Very fascinating. And I can only imagine how much data the instruments themselves generate, not to mention just the general work of solving some of these problems. Can you talk about how you are dealing with that influx of data for different applications and what some of the tools are that you use there?
Right. So a couple of years ago, we basically had no tools, I would say. So, you know, our workflow was that all of the data would come onto the computer that was connected to our camera, and then we'd copy it over to a network storage device that we had. Then we'd copy it from there to a workstation that we had, and on that workstation we would do all of the processing and visualization and information extraction. And the problem that we ran into is we started getting bigger and bigger cameras that ran faster and faster, and we were constantly running out of storage space, so we were having to, you know, basically erase data on a weekly basis because we couldn't store it all and we didn't know what to do with it. And people, you know, the people who come to us, they're experts in their field, but they're not experts in data. You know, they just want this as a tool. They want an image to come out and to answer a question, but they're not, you know, high performance computing experts. And so what we did started a couple years ago, and I should say that this is sort of true at a lot of the beamlines at the ALS, where just in the last few years, because of the brightness of our X-rays, we're able to do experiments quickly, and the new detectors are making it just giving us a lot more data than we had before. So anyway, what we started to do a couple years ago is initiated a collaboration with the Computational Research Division here at Berkeley Lab, as well as with NERSC, our local high-performance computer. And what we basically did is said, okay, we can't handle this data in the way that we're doing right now. There's no way we can keep up. We're falling farther and farther behind. How are we going to deal with this? And so we came up with a plan where, and this is sort of in progress now, where as data is collected, it's sort of bundled at a server that's at the beamline, and then immediately it's transferred to NERSC, to our high-performance computer. And then when it gets to NERSC, it gets put in a database, and then immediately, based on the metadata that we send off with that data, there's a bunch of processing jobs that are automatically launched to do all the pre-processing. And basically, we take the processing as far as we can for each individual data set. And then that data is, you know, all the results of that are all also put in the database. And then on top of all of this, we've built this web-based data portal. So all of the people who come and collect data at my Beamline, they get accounts on the data portal. They're able to just, through a web interface, log in. They're able to look at their data. They can actually see simple visualizations of their data. And, you know, we're trying to add more and more options for them to do more processing that they can, you know, they can launch processing jobs that run on the high-performance computer from a web interface that they can access anywhere. So that's sort of the direction that we're trying to go with to handle our data better.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like then you faced at one point not a storage issue, not a processing issue, but an overall workflow problem that you had to work out between multiple resources then.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. And I mean, it's funny because when I first when we first started talking, and not just me, but a few of us from the Advanced Light Source, when we first started talking to people in the computational research division, it was actually really, really frustrating because I felt like we were not speaking the same language. So, you know, I remember a specific meeting where we sat down and we, you know, in the email setting up the meeting, we had said, okay, we're going to talk about our big data problem. And we sat down, we told them, and they asked what our data set sizes were, and they told us, you don't have a big data problem. And it's because, you know, the scale of the data that they knew that they could handle, you know, these petabytes and exabytes or whatever, it was a totally different scale than what we had. But, you know, after having various meetings, they started to understand that you know, for us, it was a big data problem. And I heard someone from ESnet, the Energy Sciences Network, say, you know, everybody's data is big to them. And that's sort of how we felt. But So, I mean, even though our data, you know, we don't have exabytes of data, we do have a lot of data. And it's more than any of the users of our facility can handle on their own. And so that's why we're sort of trying to give them tools. You know, we're trying to give them tools that allow them to deal with this data.
So if you had to crystallize some of the lessons that you've learned in terms of creating this larger workflow to manage and handle all of your data, what are some of those lessons to other centers or organizations that are dealing with similar challenges, no matter what application area they are, whether they're in an enterprise setting or a national lab?
I think that the biggest thing that I've learned is that it's really important to have long-term collaborations between the computing experts and the sort of end users of the thing. You know, like I said, when we first started having meetings, we just didn't understand each other. We weren't speaking the same language. You know, the word workflow to me meant something totally different than the word workflow meant to the computing experts. And visualization, even, like just simple words that like you'd think are pretty straightforward, it turns out those words mean totally different things. And so it's only been, you know, over the course of a couple of years that we've been working together that I feel like we're actually now starting to like really understand each other. We're starting to get on the same page. And that's allowing us to really make some good progress.
Well, great. Thanks for sharing that. One final question for you, if you don't mind. Just how much data are we talking about? If you could throw some numbers, even approximate out there for what you guys were generating.
Okay, so for my Beamline, I can give the example. We, on average, are generating 1 to 2 terabytes of raw data per day. And then once you process that, those are 2D images that we collect, and because we're doing tomography, and what you have to do is turn that into 3D images, and so that you generate a bunch of scratch files along the way, and then you come up with your processed data. And so at the end of the day, we can generate, you know, 3, 4, 5 terabytes of data per day. And that happens every day. And we are one of 40 beamlines at the ALS. So not all of the beamlines are producing as much data, obviously. But does that give you some idea?
Yeah, sure. It's just funny to hear stories like this, that data begets more data in every case.
Right.
So, yeah, well, very interesting.
You know, one thing that's that we've talked a lot about is that, you know, we feel like what we've done so far is just the beginning. Like, to us, like this the data management part, which is what we've made the most progress on, is the boring part. It's just like plumbing. Like, why is it so hard to like just schlep some data around and make it accessible? The thing that we really want to talk about is, like, we want to use the word big analysis instead of big data, Because big analysis is where it's, that's what we want to get to, and that's what we're really excited about. But that's, we feel like, is a really big challenge for what we're doing. Because, like, as I told you about before, we're doing, like, a million different applications. And, you know, the person who's doing the battery research cannot use anything like the same algorithms and, you know, information extraction, you know, pipeline that the bone researcher can do or the, you know, other researchers can do. So there's just so many different applications, and each of them needs, you know, these specialized algorithms to extract their information. And so, you know, that's sort of the next frontier for us, is how to do this big analysis and how to sort of make, you know, sort of how can we help these people who are experts in bones or experts in batteries but not experts in dealing with big data or extracting this information, how can we give them tools that will let them do that? How can we give them tools that are flexible enough to deal with all these different data sets?
Well, great. Hey, Dulip, thank you so much for sharing all this. It's been really interesting, and I think what you talked about is going to resonate with a lot of researchers out there that are facing similar problems. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Take care.